that I think your mind is playing tricks on you. Well, there's something even deeper in our being. There's the heart, like the soulish part of an individual, who you really are. It's like when we die, the part of who you really are doesn't die. It goes, that being goes somewhere. And I take that to be the biblical notion of the heart. There's the mind, there's the heart. We have these differentiations, and they're hard to specify at times, but the deep place, the inner person. And from our birth, unfortunately, there's this distortion that is kind of baked in to the heart of every person. Prior to sin, Adam and Eve in their being were perfect through and through, and everything was clear. But when sin came into the world, distortion, and so you still can know some things and discern to some degree, but you always have to be careful and at least not acknowledge the distortion. And as we move further along in time, we also have the distortions that are of this world. And Satan himself, the father of lies, who is continually assaulting us with deception. And hence the imagery that the Apostle Paul brings forward, taking up the shield of faith, because you got the fiery darts of the enemy, which are by and large lies, 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 lies. And we don't want them to lodge in our being, taking up the shield of faith, and then bringing forth the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God, truth. So, antidote. And I count it once again, the orchestration of the Holy Spirit, that opening we had today. She led her opening with the verse that is our lead verse, and that was pointed out to me, and by someone else, I said, yep, as per usual. But let us reflect once again, Jeremiah 17:9. The heart is deceitful above all things, and desperately sick, who can understand it? We do have, as I said, the external sources of deception, Satan and the world system that is under his deception and promulgates his lies, and that certainly is a force to contend with. I tend to say even more than that is the internal spewings of trickery, of deceit, and so there's enough problems within, let alone without. 3 weeks ago, I had given a message, which I would advise you to listen to if you haven't heard it, called Teachings of Demons, one of the more important messages I feel that I've been privileged to give this year. And those deceptions had to do with I deserve better and I can make myself better. And then a few weeks ago, we went internal. This is Heart Tricks Part 3. And so a couple weeks ago, the internal lie that we often operate from is I am better than you or I'm more important. And then last week was others have it better than me. So the whole jealousy thing and imagining that somehow we're disadvantaged and what comes of that. So today we're going to look at another deception that comes from within that bubbles up and can come to dominate us if we're not careful. And another verse which goes along the lines of today's trick is Proverbs 28:26. Whoever trusts in his own mind is a fool. And so we want to look at this particular deception, and it is, I know better than everyone else. Or it's the I'm the smartest person in the room syndrome. A cocky-like confidence, being confident in things that that you probably shouldn't be confident. 1 Corinthians 8, 1 through 2 helps to set the tone for today's message. And Paul was writing to people that had much learning, a very cosmopolitan, sophisticated city. And even in the first chapter, as he opens this letter and carefully deals with immature people who think more highly of themselves than they ought to, he does say that they are gifted and that they come behind in no spiritual gifts. And so God's Spirit is there, and they're truly Christians. But the problem is that they've got this foolish confidence, this trust in their own way of seeing things, which, A, is a sign of their immaturity, and B, also is dangerous for those in their sphere of influence. And it comes to a certain fine or specific point in chapter 8. And he opens up this discussion, which actually runs 3 chapters. So, of course, you want to check later to make sure I'm in context, not mishandling the word. But if you read chapters 8 through 10, they're all around this really about this certainty and uncertain matters, like a foolish confidence. And so to the verses here, 1 Corinthians 8, 1. Now, concerning food offered to idols, we know that all of us possess knowledge. And it's in quotes, and probably rightly so, in that it was maybe a motto or a saying that they had. All of us possess knowledge. This knowledge, Paul now points out, this type of a certainty in matters uncertain, this knowledge actually puffs up. It creates pride and arrogance, causes one to be cocky and foolish. Whereas, but love builds up. If anyone imagines that he knows something, he does not yet know as he ought to know. Now, let me just back up for a moment and give a brief little aside concerning knowledge in general. The whole concept of knowledge. What can we actually know? Well, I remember when I was growing up, I came to certain points of beginning to reflect upon and even challenge my knowledge. Like, is this real? Is this life like a just not really there? And deep thoughts for a young kid. And perhaps you've thought that way too. And in fact, in the field of philosophy, there's a whole study that is just that is directed towards that. That is, what can we actually know? Can I actually know anything? And does anybody know what field that is, by the way? Epistemology. Yay, what a great word. Epistemology is like the study of knowing, or the science of what can we actually know. And so philosophers who had too much time on their hands began to question, is existence real? Can anything actually be known? And perhaps you've heard of the quote from one René Descartes, where he was pondering things, and he came up with the Latin cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. So again, he had too much time on his hands, wondering if he actually existed. How can I know I actually exist? And his conclusion was, well, because I can think, I actually must exist. Yes, that's the answer. And so that all might be like, well, you're kind of wasting our time right now, Pastor, move along. But when you come into the modern world, you often run into this as well, especially when you begin to give the message of Christ and you're speaking in terms of absolutes, like with what Evie opened today. perfect tie-in today, where you're talking to somebody and they can begin to go down this slippery slope. You know, well, how do you know that's true? And can we even know truth? Even Pilate threw up his hands. What is truth? Like a kind of relativism that you can't actually know. And there's not like certainty that can be found. And so today, I certainly don't want to put forward that knowledge somehow doesn't have value, that we really can't know things. Indeed, we can know things. God gave us a brain, and he made reality in such a way that we can certainly know that there are things that are certain, like 2 + 2 always equal 4, and gravity, it actually works. You know, try to defy it for too long, and you'll find out. There are absolutes, and so there's a certain amount of things that we can know, and we can rest in that knowledge. And then, of course, in the spiritual matters, in terms of Christianity, in terms of Jesus and his work, his historical work, and his work in the heavenlies, we don't have to do like this back and forth. Oh, is it real? Can I really know that? There are absolutely things that we rest in knowing, maybe not as fully. You know, the Bible does say that right now we know in part. So there's some things that we can know, and God has given us that revelation of things spiritual, of things earthly. But then there's coming a point where we will understand clearly, like face to face. Things are a little foggy right now, but someday, you know, it's like a child. They might understand some things in basic ways, but they come to a point where, oh, that's made crystal clear. And that ultimately is when we get to heaven, God will make everything certain. And so let me put forward two different dispositions. There's a healthy disposition that is like a partial knowledge presupposition to basically have it in your heart that there are things that I can know, but my knowledge is partial at this point. In this world, I will never be 100%, you know, contrary to the lust for knowledge and always having Google to, you know, give me knowledge and now AI. To be content that I can only know so much, partial knowledge, and to let that just be the basis for my life, versus another side, which is like a full knowledge fallacy. Like, I always have to have full knowledge. If I do enough research, then I can find out 100%. And that's like the drive that is out there with really embedded in us from the garden, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. You know, Satan's offer was, why have partial when you can have full? And it's like, yeah, you know, God has full. Why can't I have full right now? And so there's like those two different paradigms, if you will, or ways of thinking. And to be, at this point, content with partiality or partial knowledge versus a lust for understanding and always having to go down rabbit trails and always having to be abreast of what's going on and tuning into the news all the time because, after all, I should know and I have a right to know, you know, as though you can fully come to know something And really, it's a fallacy in and of itself. Now, back to the Corinthians. So these Corinthian saints were very boastful in certain presuppositions or ideas. And one of these ideas that had embedded in their minds was that we have a liberty to do certain practices. We are absolutely certain that it is all right, back to verse 1, it is all right for us to eat food offered to idols. And so we're convinced, after all, and as you read the three chapters, you kind of get more of this, but after all, the idol is nothing, and God has set us free from this paganism, because there's only one God. And so why is it that we should not eat this food offered to idols? We've got that freedom. We've got that liberty. Now, Paul, he challenges this conclusion, this foolish confidence that they have in, we're convinced that we can do as we please in this matter. And then Paul, he says, well, actually, you're wrong in this. This type of knowledge, this type of conclusion that you've come up with, that you're all certain of, is not going to help other people. It puffs you up, and it makes you proceed in a way in which you're not conscientious of others. And so it's not about love. It's not factoring in a larger picture, which God is always concerned about. You're very specific. You're just looking at one little angle of this matter, and almost like a child in that short-sightedness. Oh, we've made our case to ourselves. We've convinced ourselves. And so this, we all possess this knowledge. We can do as we please. By the way, how convenient for a carnal heart, by the way. We can do as we please, and we've got our theological evidence, and we've also got, we confirm each other in this matter. All of us possess this knowledge. We can do this practice. However, what they don't factor in is the fact that what they're doing has a potential to stumble other Christians. Other Christians, which may have a weakness, if you will, in that matter, where if you're eating food offered to idols, and then I see that, and I guess that's license for me to do it too, even though in my conscience, that convicts me. I used to worship those idols, and now when I go back and I eat that food that has been offered up to idols, then what I'm actually doing is I'm sinning against God. And so these weak brothers and sisters would be tripped up by the arrogant certainty of those who have this foolish confidence that I know better than God in this matter, and I know better than others in this matter. And so Paul is delicately correcting them. I mean, the whole epistle is a pastoral correction, because they've got so many of these ideas that from one angle may appear right, but in other ways, they're totally off. And so this is a form of deception that these Corinthians are dealing with. Now, later in this chapter, Paul talks about this knowledge in 1 Corinthians 8. And he says, by your knowledge, this weaker brother is destroyed. And so you've convinced yourselves, you have this idea embedded in your mind and coming up from your heart, that I can do this, and I've the case is certain. Everything, the logic is impeccable. But that very knowledge becomes destructive and corrupting to other brothers and sisters. How can that be from God? Now, this idea of destruction, and it transitions very conveniently into a man in the Old Testament, a man of infamy. And his name was King Saul. And we see also in what I'm about to read in this narrative that King Saul has a very small mind, if you will. He focuses on a few things here and there, and then he just kind of has this watertight case, at least in his mind, that this is the way things are. And how he operates based on those assumptions. Because after all, he's the smartest guy in the room. And he's not a guy that's open to counsel. Samuel has already left him. And there's no doubt that everybody in Saul's sphere of influence, all of his counselors by name, I guess in quotes, are probably scared to death to give him any reproof and challenge him. And we'll certainly see an example of why I would say nobody wants to challenge this guy. And so he basically lives off of his own skewed view of things. In 1 Samuel 20, verses 27 through 33, but on the second day, the day after the new moon, David's place was empty. And Saul said to Jonathan, his son, why has not the son of Jesse come to the meal, either yesterday or today? Jonathan answered Saul, David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. Now, Jonathan is Saul's son, if you don't know that. Verse 29. He said, let me go, for our clan holds a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to be there. So now, if I have found favor in your eyes, let me get away and see my brothers. For this reason, he has not come to the king's table. Then Saul basically throws a fit. Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan, and he said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know? You see, this is a person that is subject to believing that he is the smartest guy, that his case is certain, and everything in his mind, the way he sees things, is the absolute way it is. Do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? And as I read this, of course, it's easy to look back and to point the finger. I mean, King Saul is a very convenient example for all many things in the negative sense. But how often is that me? How often have I these settled thoughts in my mind that I've made my own case? All these pieces of evidence have come together, and I just basically blow up. And I throw a fit, and I go all accusational and make everybody in the room, everybody that's around me, uncomfortable. Because after all, I see this 100%. This is the way it is. That person did that because of this, and volcanic eruption. Do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? Verse 31. For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established. Therefore, send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die. Then Jonathan answered Saul, his father, why should he be put to death? What has he done? But Saul hurled a spear at him to strike him. So Jonathan knew that his father was determined to put David to death. Now, it's kind of an incongruent, just a strange thing that's happening here, in that Saul is arguing about Jonathan, basically, you know, you're the heir apparent, you should be king, you should be concerned about your reign, and then he goes out of his way to kill the one that he's talking about, that, you know, you should be the king, and you should be concerned about David, who could mess up those plans. Very, very inconsistent, very, very crazy. And there's a lot of assumptions here. A person that is sold out on their thinking, and they have these confidences and that aren't real, they draw a lot of conclusions and they operate from a lot of assumptions. I mean, think about the assumptions here with Saul. Saul is basically saying, Jonathan, I know what you're thinking. Here, this is the way you're thinking, Jonathan. I am absolutely certain that you have had this plan for David to take over. And how can that be so? How can Saul actually know what Jonathan is thinking? It's just there's so much of this certainty. I know better than everybody else. I know what you're thinking. Or I know that you don't want to be king. That seems to be absolutely certain in Saul's mind. And he says, you don't want to be king, obviously. Or I know that you should be motivated with the same motivations that I have. And that's all Saul is thinking about, is the persistency of his political reign through his family. And there's an assumption there that Jonathan, you should be thinking the exact way. And there's a lot of other things that he's assuming, but the bottom line is that Saul is dominated by this sense of expertise, by the sense of, I absolutely know these things are happening, And so he becomes a very dangerous man. And that can be true for any of us. When we're dominated by what I'll call asphyxiating assumptions, things that we just feel, this is the reality. Like, let's say with your spouse. Let's say, and I don't know which way to go, husband or wife here, and so I'll just leave it open. Let's say with your spouse, if every day your spouse comes home and your spouse is quiet, maybe they seem a little agitated, well, over time, the other spouse can start to assume that, man, they just must be angry with me. They must be angry with me. And then, of course, you know, what did I do wrong? And then maybe start going down that path. When in actuality, the truth of the matter, apart from this partial understanding that you can begin to build your case and think, well, they hate me, they don't like me, they have contempt for me. The truth of the matter is that they're just tired and they've had a long day and it's nothing about you, but you can build a case that this is about you. Or let's say you have a spouse, and I guess it'd be easy to guess which way this would go. Let's say you have a spouse that they're just not communicative. And the other spouse goes, you know, so what are you thinking about? And this spouse, I mean, maybe you can guess the gender of that spouse, can get a little nervous and, you know, I'm not thinking about anything. And this spouse, right, who is always thinking, how can you not be thinking about something? And starts maybe to build a case in their mind and doesn't allow for a greater degree of truth. They're just, and how much of our life is lived that way, where we build these little cases based on partial knowledge because I know better. I know exactly what's going on. I know they're doing this. I know that that happened because of this. And how many of these assumptions and what we basically begin, like Saul, he's living by this assumption, and he becomes a very dangerous person. And his life is not a happy existence because he's ruled by these asphyxiating, choking assumptions. It basically destroys inner peace. And so back to a marriage, when you got these cases being built in one another's hearts and you're assuming more than what's actually there, then there's not going to be peace in the hearts of those spouses, just like there's no peace in Saul's heart. He's a miserable, paranoid guy. And it also ruins relationships. How many relationships get ruined because the heart allows this deception to come up that I know better. I exactly know what's going on. I see the full perspective here, when in actuality, you just see a little slice of the pie of all that can be known about a particular situation. And some examples of what happens when we allow dominating, asphyxiating assumptions to rule us. One example, which all of us maybe have experienced in our lives, is like a financial blunder. Like we get something presented to us. Someone sells us on something that, man, this is a great deal. And we kind of think, yeah, you know, after all, I'm the smartest person in the room, and I can kind of size that up too. So you just kind of buy into it. And or maybe you invest in that. You know, all the guys on Reddit made a great case as to why this stock's going to the moon. And so, yeah, you know, I see clearly. And you jump in, and you end up being on the wrong side of it because they were doing a big pump and dump to you. Or like a great example, which some of us might be related to, I hope all of us have exposure to this example at some point, not that it's a necessity, is Ralph Cramden and the Honeymooners. How many of those episodes were about Ralph Cramden basically being the smartest guy in the room and having, from his perspective, this great deal? It's always about get-rich-quick schemes, by the way. And, you know, I can't lose. And then, of course, the show always shows him going about And there's certainly no inner peace. There's no relational peace between him and Alice because it's always a new scheme. There was one episode where he bought a full inventory of these kitchen utensils, which were about like being the chef of the future. And he's already put all that money into that. He bought them all. And then he's trying to convince Alice why she has to give him money so that now he can make a commercial. And so it's like this, you know, once again, I can't lose. This is like foolproof. And so he's totally convinced. And, you know, he goes, don't you see, Alice? Don't you see that? Don't you want to be rich, Alice? You know, it's like, you know, she's got the problem. She doesn't know any better. You know, you must not want to be rich. And he goes, do you know how long it would take me to sell these if I went door to door? And she goes, yeah, in 5 minutes if you were the person at the first door. And then, you know, it's the usual. Ralph's like, you know, to the moon, Alice. But anyway, but how many get burned in financial schemes? They get burned in something that just seemed so perfect. And they maybe didn't ask counsel. They didn't maybe take a little time. And because they just assumed up front, yeah, I'm sizing this up properly, and I see this. This is basically foolproof. Or here's another result. When we think we know better than everybody else and we're unwilling to challenge that assumption, we don't have enough humility to say, well, maybe I don't see that whole perspective. But how much, like, unforgiveness has gone on in the world, maybe in our lives, because we sized up a situation and we categorized it and we said, this is absolutely what happened, and now I don't forgive that person. Watertight case. I remember in my family years ago, there was a great aunt that I hadn't talked to in years, and I decided to give her a call, and you know, she goes, oh, this is Ronnie? And yeah, you know, Ron Sr.'s son. Ron, oh, yeah, good, because I'm not going to talk to Ron Sr. Why didn't she want to talk to Ron Sr., my dad? Because she was mad at him and his brothers that somehow she didn't get something in some inheritance, and she felt slighted. And so from that point forward, I dismissed these people. There's definitely unforgiveness there. And I know nobody can relate to anything like that, right? Because inheritances always go smooth, right, in this world. How many inheritances do break up families? But things that you just have this thought that this is absolutely the way it happened. That's this parent, this brother, this sister. I absolutely just 100% understand what happened, and I proceed from that. Now, I'm not saying that we can't know some things for certain. Okay, there are things that we can know 100%. But that's probably a very small part of the knowledge pie, a small slice of the knowledge pie that is in this life. And so there's many things that we can be convinced, yeah, this happened to me, that happened to me, and now I make a choice to resent, to be hostile, to be distant from them, to not forgive them. And some of that because it's embedded in I know better. I know absolutely what happened. When there might come a point when you get a greater understanding, maybe in this life, you say, oh, there's a whole other side to that. I didn't realize that there was this element going on. And I've been living in unforgiveness because I just made a choice to think that my narrow perspective was the 100% perspective. And then how many things in heaven, when we get to heaven, and we had all these relational tensions and difficulties, and we get there, and all of a sudden we see face to face, and some of us are going to have great regret. And I'm not saying it's a deal breaker because we're only saved by faith in Jesus, but things that will be made clear there, and wow, I allowed a relationship to die or allowed that tension in my own heart because I just thought I knew better. I thought I was 100% on that. Or even like the last couple messages, really, they tie into this. Like 2 weeks ago, I'm better than you. And how I could just have that confident, cocky arrogance that somehow I'm more advanced or I'm ahead and I should be treated with greater dignity or respect or something. Or last week, unhealthy comparisons. There's that element that I know exactly what's going on in that situation. And they're doing better than me. Are you sure you know exactly what's going on there? Perhaps you're allowing a fallacy. Perhaps you're allowing this heart trick to control you, which has this assumption that I know better than everybody else. And so let's look, as we conclude now, to some ways to help mitigate this deception of the heart. First of all, Jeremiah 10:23, a great verse. I know, O Lord, so there's something I can know. I know, O Lord, that the way of man is not in himself, that it is not in man who walks to direct his steps. So I know that I don't know how to direct my life. That's a great, he knows at least one thing. I talked about the philosophical branch of knowledge earlier. And there was this group that developed in that whole philosophical school. They were called the absolute skeptics. An absolute skeptic says that nothing can be known. But over time, either somebody pointed out or somebody wised up in that group, right? The absolute skeptic says nothing can be known. But then you would hopefully catch that, wait a minute, you've just made an absolute statement. So certainly something can be known if you're saying absolutely that nothing can be known, right? And so they eventually changed their moniker to modified skeptics. That, yeah, can't know everything, but there's at least one thing there. And that's kind of like, I see that with Jeremiah here. I can know certainly that I can't know everything certainly. And as you get older, that's also something that happens at least to some of us. When you're younger, there's this, maybe as your knowledge increases, there's also a puffing up that goes on. And I'm not criticizing younger people. It's just probably part of the progress of life. And so your brain wakes up and all of a sudden, yeah, you know, I'm accumulating knowledge and learning, and that's good, but there can be a corresponding arrogance with that and a certainty about things, a certain maybe degree of legalism and judging others harshly, being quick to point the accusing finger, sizing things up very fast. But then as time goes along, you become the victim of that long enough to where, you know, maybe that's not such a good thing. And B, you begin to get an understanding of the degree of that which can be understood. And you find out at one time, yeah, I thought I pretty much sized everything up, but what can be known is well beyond what I've ever thought. And I only know a little sliver. So as you get older, you'll hear it said, or maybe you'll say, that I know a lot less than I once thought I did. My knowledge is, in fact, there's a humility about I don't know. There's more of that. When I was younger, as a pastor, I wanted to be a little bit more absolute and have an answer for everything. But moving along, there's been times where the answer is to a question, I don't know. And that's okay. But thankfully, I know the one who does know. And let us go together and ask him or continue in your pursuit. I don't have to because of a desire to maybe impress or because I have such a degree of certainty when I was younger that I have to absolutely answer everything. And so Jeremiah had that humility about him for the things that he asked God about. And he complained often in his book, you know, why this, why that, and I wish I wasn't born, and all these things. But he at least had this about him. I know, O Lord, that the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man who walks to direct his steps. I humbly submit myself to you and to your leading and to your guidance. I don't have to have an opinion about everything. I don't have to try to size everything up and be so certain about things. Here's another thing, knowledge that matters. Jeremiah 9:23-24, thus says the Lord, let not the wise man boast in his wisdom. So you can have wisdom, you can be wise, just don't boast in it. Let not the mighty boast in his might, let not the rich boast in his riches. And then we come back to the subject of knowledge and wisdom in verse 24, but let him who boasts boast in this, that he understands and knows me, that I am the Lord who practices steadfast love, justice, and righteousness in the earth. For in these things I delight, declares the Lord. Knowledge that actually matters is knowing the Lord, having a desire to know God. Oh, that I might know you. Paul said that we might know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his suffering. He did not say that he had sized up God and he had mastered that subject, but it was a process. And brothers and sisters, I would also say that when we get to glory and we're in that eternal paradise realm, we will never fully size up God. There will always be an incomprehensibility. We can understand him to degrees, and I believe we'll be learning him through all eternity, but we'll never know him 100%, because if we did, then we'd be part of the Godhead itself. We'd be like the fourth member of the Trinity, I guess the quadrinity, and that's not going to happen. And so if one is to boast, boast in your relationship with God, that and have a humility that I can't know all things, and nor am I designed, nor should that be my motivation to be like the know-it-all, but I'm drawing close to God, and I'm learning his nature. Not only am I learning his nature, but his nature's rubbing off on me. I also am growing in character, and the fruits of the Spirit are being produced to me. I don't know exactly how it happens, but it happens. I desire to know God. Do you desire to know God, by the way? Do you have that curiosity and that inquiry? Do you have that desire to know your God? That's knowledge that actually matters. A wise person would hone in on just that area if they're going to specialize at the expense of the rest. But a worldly wise person is, oh, I got to kind of know a little bit about everything and be able to size up things and give my opinions. But a Christian doesn't have to be bogged down and overcome with that worldly sense of knowledge and learning. I can know the Lord. And when I know the Lord, that's where life and peace comes from. And like a child of a parent, a child can have that security that guy, that gal, mom or dad, or that papa, that nana, I have a security that they kind of know. And I don't have to know everything that's going on here. And that's us with God, to have that rest in your heart. Are you restless, by the way, because you've got this carnal, worldly side that I've got to be the one that knows it all? Reminds me of a character, cartoon character, Rocky and Bullwinkle. Going back again, how many remember Rocky and Bullwinkle? So every so often, they would do all these shorts, and Bullwinkle would be like Mr. Know-It-All. Remember any of those, Mr. Know-It-All? And so he'd always like have this book, you know, Mr. Know-It-All here, and he'd draw these conclusions, and then the humor was that as he went out to show his certain conclusion, this is totally certain, it would always be disappointed. He would be disappointed. He would be in some way put to shame. And so that was the humor behind the episode, is the guy that thinks he knows it all is always stumbling over the things he's assuming. So, okay, maybe not the best illustration. Okay. Proverbs 9:10, here's what matters. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is insight. And so highly regard your God, revere your God. And now the wisdom that is necessary, not the wisdom of the world, not just the accumulation of data, not just intellectual prowess and satisfying all my curiosities, but the wisdom that is from God. I regard God. I come to Him. I want to know Him. He is lofty. He is to be revered. I'm awestruck. Even there's some terror in there. It's a fearful thing to fall in the hands of a living God. The fear of the Lord brings forth that form of wisdom. And the knowledge of the Holy One, now there's insight. When you begin to know God, that's when you begin to know yourself. And you then have an understanding of the world around you. The world goes backwards. It ignores God. It studies incessantly the inside, nonstop psychological analysis and such. And then one assumes, oh, I got a grasp on things. Now I can deal with the outer world. But the way of God, come to God, He'll give you insight. You'll understand. And at times it'll be humiliating once you know what's really there, but that's fine. It's better than the alternative. He gives you insight, and then you know how to proceed. Then you know how to live. And then also, why don't you take a break? A person that thinks they're the smartest person in the room has to always have it's very demanding. They must know. They always have to form opinions. They have to do the comparison thing, and so how about giving it a rest? Ecclesiastes 1:16 through 18. Here's a guy that learned after the fact. I said in my heart, I've acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I want to know everything. I perceive that this also is but a striving after the wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Do you really have to know everything? Do you have to do incessant research? Do you have to kind of cover all the bases, and you have this mastery disposition, and I know better than everybody else now? How much good did that do for Solomon? That wisdom, the wisdom of the world, the wisdom of a prideful person, actually, it was vexation to him, and it increased sorrow in his life. Or to put it in a positive sense, Psalm 131, 1 through 2. This may be an exercise, but how helpful it is. O Lord, my heart is not lifted up. My eyes are not raised too high. I do not occupy myself with things too great and too marvelous for me. But I have calmed and quieted my soul like a weaned child with its mother. Like a weaned child is my soul within me. How many of you have ever wished that you had a pause button in your brain? I so wish I could just stop thinking. Now, earlier, maybe in a humorous fashion, talked about a particular spouse that the other one would say, you don't think anything? But it'd be nice to be able to kind of pause an incessant desire to know, doing research. I need to know what my spouse is doing at all times. I need to know what my kids are doing at all times. I gotta have a grasp on things. Now, I'm not saying there's not responsibilities, of course, but there are things which you're not going to be able to control. There are things which may remain a mystery until you get to the other side. And the wise psalmist here was able to say, I don't occupy. Now, that may not have been every day, but at least this point, I've learned to restrain. I don't occupy myself with the things that are too great and too marvelous. I'm not assuming that I understand everything and I need to understand everything and I got to put forth this expertise vibe. I'm going to take a break. like a child with a parent. How nice that would be, by the way. Isn't that a great psalm? It's actually three verses, so I just have two of them there. Short psalm. And then finally, this pastoral prayer is how I would like to pray over us today. Paul often prayed over the saints. And he wasn't trying to make an excuse for ignorance and just be lazy and, you know, you don't have to know anything. That certainly is not what has been presented today either. But just to have the right knowledge, to have a humility about you, and to not see yourself in larger terms or to think more highly of yourself than you ought to. And so I'd like us, if we could, to stand together. And I'd like to close by praying this, a pastoral prayer from Scriptures, and be on our way. And also, if you don't know Jesus as your Savior, I'll be up here after service and would love to pray with you and make sure that most important matter is dealt with. But if we could close our eyes. Father, as I pray this prayer from Scriptures that you have preserved for us for our benefit, help us, God, to take of this wisdom, this godly wisdom, and let it be in our lives. I do not cease to give thanks for you, remembering you in my prayers, that the God of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of glory, may give you the spirit of wisdom and revelation in the knowledge of him, having the eyes of your hearts enlightened, that you may know what is the hope to which he has called you, what are the riches of his glorious inheritance in the saints, and what the immeasurable greatness of his power is toward us who believe, according to the working of his great might. Lord, indeed, let it be. Help us to receive of your wisdom. Help us also to pray as parents, these pastoral prayers over our children. And let us continue to serve you with meekness and to receive from you at the pace, in the right amounts, the revelation that you have for us, that is necessary for us. We just dedicate ourselves to you, Lord Jesus Christ. Amen. Godspeed to you.